Well, here in Aotearoa, we are much better off than most in our ability to get together. This holiday season, other countries are in various forms of COVID lockdown, as we've just been discussing. Still, there remain thousands of New Zealanders unable to get back here for the traditional gatherings. Might be time for some reinvention. Priya Parker studies and designs gatherings, and she recommends taking a leaf from the improvisation handbook, if such a thing isn't an oxymoron. She's the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and How It Happens, and host of the New York Times podcast Together Apart. She's also a conflict facilitator, which probably comes in handy for a lot of family get-togethers. And there is a reason that Priya Parker does what she does.
I'm biracial. I'm bicultural. My mother is an Indian immigrant and my father is white American. They actually met at Iowa State University in the States in the 70s. And for the first kind of 10 or 12 years of their marriage, they were each other's sources of adventure. I was born in Zimbabwe because it was the best good hospital that would accept an interracial couple at the time near the village that we were living in. We lived in Indonesia. We lived in India. We moved to The Hague. Just sort of every 6 months or a couple of years, they'd pick up and move. And eventually we moved back to the States and eventually to Virginia. And within a year, they had separated. And within 2 years, they divorced. And within 3 years, they had each remarried other people. And in many ways, they had chosen people that reflected kind of the original worldviews from which they came. And they chose to have joint custody, and I was their only child. And so every 2 weeks, I would go back and forth between these two homes. And on a Friday afternoon, I would leave my mother and stepfather's house, and it was this Indian, British, vegetarian, meditating, incense-filled, atheist, agnostic on hopeful days, theosophist, liberal, democratic, global family. And I would take my car 1.4 miles, or I'd be driven to my father and stepmother's home. And it was and still is a white, American, evangelical Christian, conservative, Republican, twice a week church going, sports playing, meat eating family. And I was really a part of both. And in a sense, I was also apart from each. I mean, almost literally every 2 weeks I was gone. And I have always been interested in when and why and how we come together, and also when and why and how we come apart. And I knew from a very young age, and then through my work as a conflict resolution facilitator, it doesn't take a shrink to explain that connection, that we invent our cultures. We invent and we also inherit our ways of being. And in part because I think I was, in a sense, part of three families, the family my parents created, and then the second and third families that kind of each created, I came up in a context where I saw that there are many ways to be.
And because we invent our cultures, you're suggesting that we can reinvent them as well.
You know, every culture, every family, every nation, every company, at some moment in time, created a response to a real need in front of them. So whether that's the way a family celebrates an elder's birthday, you know, every year, 1 year, there's a huge snowstorm. And so everyone got their shovels out, I'm making this up, right? And started digging and playing in this huge snow fight. And then for years afterwards, people all brought their shovels that night, you know, to celebrate grandpa's birthday. Or if you think like Passover Seder, the beginning of this period in March, I was supposed to be producing a podcast with the New York Times that was supposed to have been called Gathering with Priya Parker. And then COVID hit and my producer texted me and he said, you know, a show about gathering is now going to sound like a horror film. Like we have to stop. and we need to rethink this. And we paused, and I noticed that I was still getting emails, still getting, you know, direct messages over Instagram from strangers kind of asking this question. How do we do this? Like, how do we do this now? Do I still have my wedding? Do we pause our life for a year? Do we do it on Zoom? You know, so things that now, you know, perhaps many of your listeners have been to a Zoom wedding or unfortunately a Zoom funeral or, you know, fill in the blank, were kind of, you know, unprecedented in March. And we launched this podcast called Together Apart. And the first episode was actually Passover Seder. And I'm not Jewish, but I spoke with a rabbi based in New York named Amichai Lau Levi. And he said something interesting. He said, you know, right now, Jews around the world are trying to figure out, can we do this on Zoom? And there were some communities apparently that issued edicts, ordinances that allowed communities to actually host Passover Seder on Zoom. And he said, you know, what we think of as Passover now, hosting our own ceremonies or hosting our own evenings around the table with family and friends, was an invention some 1800 years ago when our temple was destroyed. And the way that at the time Jews celebrated or marked Passover, we could no longer do. So we had to DIY it. We had to spread and democratize and figure out how we each, rather than one rabbi at the temple, how we each host a Seder, which actually means order or structure, in our homes. And that example really struck me in part because what he was saying is every community at a moment in time responds, creates a specific response to a need in front of them. And then for generations, in some cases, if there's meaning in that response, we continue to replicate it. And this year, whether you're in New Zealand or, you know, or New York, Finland or New Delhi, we are all facing a moment that for many of us is requiring us to think about what is the need in front of us and how might we mark the holidays or a meeting or somebody's birthday in a new way that makes sense for this year.
I'm just thinking about your particular situation in the United States for a moment where, and indeed in some other countries where gatherings per se have become politicized. I mean, thanks to former President Trump in a way. You either get together in defiance or you cancel completely, but it's a signal of where you are on the political spectrum in a way. Do you factor that in?
You know, I think within the first few pages of my book, The Art of Gathering, which was actually written in 2018, I say, you know, the way we gather matters. The way we gather fills our days and our evenings, and we take it for granted. And yet there is a reason why countries that begin to slide into authoritarianism, one of the first rights those governments take away is the right to assemble. Right? Gathering has deep power. And if you actually look at it, gathering has always been political. I think one of the elements that is unfortunate in the United States right now, and I think perhaps the most extreme of any country, though I'll let you fact check that, is that it has been interwoven with a political identity that has also been tied into, unfortunately, identity markers that affect public health. Right? So masks. We now know that masks work. The fact that masks were becoming politicized. I remember reading articles back in June of the first couple of op-eds where people were starting to, you know, be yelled at visiting a local town, you know, that a relative and they came from a quote unquote mask wearing culture, right? That's not a good thing if it's a culture to wear masks and got screamed at, you know, crossing the street. So for me as a facilitator, if I step back, you know, all the way back, gathering has always and will always have power. And I think one thing that will continue, at least for some amount of time, even after enough of us are vaccinated and it's deemed, you know, safe to kind of go back outside again, is that we no longer take it for granted. I think there's a second level that's happening, is that what used to be within the kind of the niche world of the facilitator, right? The size of groups. This is like pretty technical data. I have a couple of pages in The Art of Gathering about, you know, groups of six are good for conversation, but one can't carry, you know, if one person's kind of checked out, then like you can't really carry dead weight. Everybody feels it. Groups of 12 are great for a buzzy dinner party. Groups of 30 are good for a party. We're now litigating numbers, at least in the United States, you know, across states. What number should the CDC ban? What number did the, you know, Governor Newsom of California allow his Department of Health in California to dictate how many people can be outside for Thanksgiving? So, you know, in October, the Governor of California's health department issued an ordinance around Thanksgiving and holidays in general. I'm not sure if Thanksgiving was named. And it said something like, you know, down to the details of please don't sing. If you're going to sing, wear a mask. Even the leader of the singing needs to be wearing a mask. Three families, 10 people can gather. It has to be outdoors. Like all of these elements that used to be like in the footnotes of facilitator manuals being like going viral on Twitter with people all over the country. And it was this, it was a joke among kind of the right-wing media, because if it was a funeral, you could allow 30 people, but if it was Thanksgiving, you could only have 10.
I mean, this has added a whole new dimension to your job, hasn't it?
You know, in a sense, on one hand, it's added a whole new dimension. You know, at the beginning of this global pandemic, it was possible pre-COVID for me to kind of have a Google alert of the word gather. Right? Or gathering, right? I wrote a book called The Art of Gathering. It was a term that was used, but not particularly. Like I kind of had a radar out for it. After say March, you know, 7th, March 12th, the word gathering was in, you know, most headlines around the world, and it changed. Its meaning changed. The context changed from something that was seen as like a source of meaning and beauty and connection to a source of danger and death. But if I pause and ask a question that I believe we can all ask ourselves, what is it that I know how to do? Like, what is it at underneath gathering? What is it that I know how to do? And as a facilitator, what I know how to do is create meaningful connection despite significant obstacles. I'm used to having those obstacles be race or identity or religion or, you know, marketing and sales, but COVID's a pretty big obstacle. So the first thing I would say is I think for facilitators around the world, it's been a very interesting time because we know that the things we often obsess about, whether the things people are told to obsess about, get the right wine, put the fork in this position, get the right font on the PowerPoint, actually doesn't matter. And people are now starting to see on Zoom or in these virtual calls, you need to actually think about how you're going to ask a question, how you're going to get people to meaningfully connect, how you use the chat. So for facilitators, it's been a very interesting moment because people are starting to think about connection rather than canapes.
But the Zoom then has focused people's minds on what really matters in a way.
In a way. I mean, what's interesting about Zoom is that it's a place with no context. Zoom is not the host, right? We even call it a Zoom room, but in a sense, it's everything is stripped out and we have to create the meaning. You know, I keep joking that in so many of our meetings, our work meetings, right now we're all nostalgic for the times when we used to gather. And I am too, you know, don't get that wrong. And we're forgetting that many of our gatherings were not that great. They were bland. They were boring. We were on autopilot. All of the meetings that could have become an email. But when we're physically in person, there's a lot of distraction and there's a lot of subsidies. Like the coffee's hot and great and you can go back up and fill up your tea. It's great to see a colleague in the doorway on the way in, on the way out. And so if the meeting isn't run very well, there's kind of enough other subsidies that make it worth your while. Or you can text under the table and get other stuff done. On a Zoom call, if a meeting is bad, everybody feels it pretty fast, right? There's less place to hide. And so part of what's interesting in this moment is that we actually have to be creative about how do you start your meeting? When people are coming in and out all day long, and I know this is not everybody, but you know, in and out of virtual rooms with so many different contexts. Perhaps you leave a parent-teacher conference where you are a parent, you know, 7 minutes ago wondering how your child is doing in this virtual world. And then you enter another room and you're with your colleagues, and then you leave and you go to a friend's birthday party. It's kind of like identity whiplash.
I'm talking to Priya Parker, who is an expert on gatherings. I mean, gathering's a very interesting word, isn't it? The more you say it, the more you think about it. It sounds quite spiritual in a way, gathering.
You know, it's a word. It's interesting you say that. It's actually, it is a word that's in many sacred texts. And you know, as I began to study gatherings there, whether in the Torah or the Bible or through translation from other sacred texts, it's a word that's often used with a capital G. In the Bible, you know, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, like, I will be present. I'm paraphrasing. I was told in Jewish traditions that there's certain ceremonies that can't actually happen unless there's 10 people. It's a word that understands that there is actually power when people come together. And I use it in a sense. So the way I define a gathering is anytime three or more people come together for a purpose with a beginning, middle, and end. It's something that happens that you can shift, that you can control, that we are in charge of. And the biggest mistake we make that when we gather is that we assume that the purpose is obvious and shared.
And that goes for a lot of ritual gatherings, celebratory gatherings. You have pretty much the similar bunch of people in the room that you did last year, on the Zoom as you did last year. You're suggesting that you need to shake it up a bit. What the expression you use is, embrace a specific disputable purpose. What does that mean?
So many of our gatherings tend to be bland or vague, offline or on, because we're not totally sure why we're doing them.
Because we did it last time. I mean, it's just because, what we do.
Yeah. It's just what we do. And in some contexts, like, that may be working really well, and don't touch it. And people adore the tradition. Just keep going. But what I hear as a facilitator, whether I'm working within family systems or groups, like, pretty quickly I'm a confession box where people kind of, you know, quietly pull me aside in the hallway or privately on Zoom chat saying, we've been doing this for years and everyone's afraid to say it's not working, right? So I'm talking to those people, which are more people than you'd think. So what is a specific disputable purpose? It's answering the question, what is the actual need here? Why are we doing this? If it's a wedding, right? Something, and the more obvious seeming the category, the more likely we are to skip asking, why are we doing this? So I'll give an example. I had a friend who had a grandmother. This is pre-COVID, but the analogy works. She had her 80th birthday. She actually was based in Germany. She had children and grandchildren all over the world. And her grandchildren were mostly in their 30s and 40s. So adult grandchildren. And she issued an invitation for her birthday that was quite controversial in her family. She issued an invitation only to her adult grandchildren for a weekend on her dime, no spouses, no children. And it created kind of a shockwave through the family. And everyone kind of talked about it. Long story short, they ended up doing it. And I was very curious about this invitation. And I called up a friend of mine, was one of the grandchildren. I called him up afterwards and I said, how'd it go? And he said, you know, I know, as controversial as it was, this was the first time in 30 years that I've spent time alone with my cousins who are scattered all over the country or all over the world. In a sense, when we didn't have responsibility and weren't also playing other roles, role of spouse, role of father, role of child to our parents. And over 3 days, we had this beautiful time, both remembering our bond, but also renegotiating our relationship to each other as adults. And we'll probably never do it again, but it was pretty spectacular.
So that's one answer to your earlier question, how you get people to connect meaningfully and become changed by that experience. Do things slightly differently. Enable people to see each other in a different way.
Think about the need that you have this year. And the why I keep saying this year is because your needs will change from year to year because we are changing. And then all of the birthdays don't blend into each other. I'll give another example. I had a friend who was turning 50. He never worried about his age before, but for some reason, 50 was really bothering him and he couldn't really figure out why. And he realized that the people that in his life, most of them, once they hit 50, many of them began to kind of contract. They took less risks. They made less new friends. They said no to moving cities for a specific job. And he realized he didn't want to contract. He wanted to continue to expand, whatever that meant. And so for his birthday, he decided to invite the people in his life who always represented expansion. And at the opening of his birthday, one of the things that he said was, he looked around the table, he raised a glass and he just said, you know, and he said what I just said to you. And he said, each of you in your own ways are people who have always represented expansion. And as I turn 50 this year, I wanted to be surrounded by that. And I also, as I, for the next 50 years, I want you to remind me of this night and of to always blow courage my way.
Blow courage my way is very nice, isn't it?
And that's what I mean by a meaningful gathering. He knew his need. He then witnessed and saw people in his life. And in a sense, through that, you know, minute and a half speech, it wasn't long. It's not rocket science. It's not expensive, right? He's also saying, hey, I see you. I see the, you know, I see the way the decisions that you've made in your life, and I admire them. And I want to begin to mirror them. And part of what he was doing, he wasn't using this language, but it's like that old saying, birds of a feather flock together. He was choosing his birds for this moment of his life. For his 50th first birthday, he did something else. So part of this is, it's not saying throw everything out. It's actually saying, like, this year more than anything, it's requiring all of us to ask this question that at least in America is because carries a lot of baggage, which is essential, right? What is essential? What is it that I actually am mourning the loss of? It's just an opportunity to ask, what is it that we need now and how do we want to do it in this moment?
One of the suggestions you have is that for a meaningful gathering, a fruitful gathering, you need to cause good controversy. And you talk about certain types of peace being unhealthy, presumably not talking about the elephant in the room. Let me personalise this for a moment. Your husband, last I heard, was Anand Giridharadas, who's the author of a book called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. I spoke to him earlier in the year. Very interesting book, but quite a contentious book. Is there a gathering that you have had or can imagine where he would be forced to defend some of his views in that book? Would that be a fruitful gathering?
You know, it depends on the purpose of the gathering. And I always answer with that question in part because I don't think there are like hard and fast rules. I think it depends on what the need of the group is. So with Anand, it depends on like who the host is, what the purpose of the night is. It might actually be a total distraction to, if he's at a, I'm making this up, but if he's at somebody's family's reunion or someone's baby shower or somebody's wedding and like the father of the bride is trying to take a toast and some guest is saying, hey, let's hear from Anand first. What are you, how dare you say this in this book, right? It's completely inappropriate for him to then try to take the stage and answer that question. In other contexts, it's the conversation that will transform the organization, right? And I think, you know, it's funny, I'm a conflict resolution facilitator and I'm conflict averse, right? We started this conversation with my family and my parents. And when my parents were separated, when they announced that they were separated, everybody was shocked because they never fought. And I've learned as a facilitator, both to, and as a wife to Anand Giridharadas, both to retrain my physiological responses to conflict and to risk, to be able to hold it in the room, in part because I know personally that human connection is as threatened by unhealthy peace as it is by unhealthy conflict. But I also know that it depends on the need of the group. So, you know, when I think about good controversy, another way to think about it is risk. So one of the people that I interviewed in The Art of Gathering is a woman named Ida Benedetto, and she creates experiences for people to change their relationship to risk. So before the pandemic, every year, she and her business partner would host this fake conference in the Waldorf Astoria, a hotel in New York, that where 100 people would show up in black tie, like fake black, like they're doing it because it's a fake, actually birthday party for somebody. And they were given a list of prompts, one of them being on the third floor, there's a wedding happening, crash it and give a toast to the bride. And she, and various prompts like that. And I interviewed her for this book and I said, what would you tell, like, why do you do this? And what have you learned? And she said, I am interested in transformative gatherings, whether it's wilderness retreats or somebody's birthday party. And what I have learned in my time is that transformation happens through risk, not through stagnation. And risk comes in many forms, physical, emotional, you know, intellectual. So in a church or in a synagogue, a controversy, you know, good controversy could be talking about how do we spend our tithes versus what color should the benches, should the pews be, right? In a newspaper, good controversy will be what do we put on the homepage versus what font do we use? In a family, good controversy may actually, you know, you may choose like a physical motion or physical risk or emotional risk. What if we ask people to actually share of themselves rather than just talking about nothing? So risk can take many, many, many forms. And again, it goes back to the need of the group.
You got plans for a gathering this season?
You know, a couple of different examples. I actually spoke with Ida recently because I'm feeling myself, you know, I'm feeling kind of overwhelmed and underwhelmed by the holidays. And one of the prompts that she gave that I loved and I'm experimenting with is she said, rather than hosting a party, host an adventure. And I said, what's the difference? And she said, the difference between an adventure and a party is that an adventure has a mission and puts people into motion. And I said, give an example. And she gave this lovely example, which I think we may do our own version of, which is for her 30th birthday, she had a friend who was taking photographs of all of the bathroom latches inside of bars. and she just thought it was this quirky, fun, like photography project. And she got a group of 12 people for her birthday to bundle up, put their sneakers on, and go find the best bathroom latches and bars across New York City. And years later, people still think of that as like their most fun night. And I wrote about this in a newsletter, Art of Gathering newsletter that I have. And somebody texted me this morning and said, I'm going to take that key latch idea. And instead, I've texted my whole family. And for our winter gathering this year, everybody's going to go out ahead of time and take photographs of the lights, the Christmas lights or the winter lights in their neighborhood, right? We have family all over the country in their neighborhood and share it with us like that evening. And I thought that was such a lovely idea. And so I'm thinking about different ways to connect my family and my friends that are simple, that keep us safe, grounded in our home. You know, for Thanksgiving, actually, Anand, and he allows me to share this example because there are lines between, you know, between what we do and what we speak about. For Thanksgiving this year, for Zoom, you know, a pretty American tradition, we had one set of my parents and his parents and his siblings, and we divided the evening into three parts. So one tip also, if you're listening, is think about structuring the night, having different lengths of time. Sometimes short is actually helpful, or letting people come in and out. So 6 to 7 p.m., I believe, Eastern, we had a cocktail hour. And for the cocktail hour, Anand asked everybody to share a photo of their life from 2020 ahead of time, from 2020, of a beautiful moment. And a photo from another moment in their time that was perhaps somehow worse than or competed with 2020. And we all texted our photos ahead of time. And then for a cocktail hour, we went around with our family and each shared each of these moments. And for our family, given the need of where we are, it was this lovely, actually kind of funny and also heartening moment to remember, like, we can do hard things. And also there have been pockets of light this year as well.
That's Priya Parker, who is the host of a podcast and the author of a book called Art of Gathering.